Please. Morning, church. Appreciate everybody who came out for work day yesterday, and a lot of stuff went on. So those of you who changed out faucets and cleaned floors and put up new bulletin boards and just did an overall cleaning, we had a lot of people doing a lot of things, and so it was just a really nice turnout. And so if you see things changed or cleaned up, it was kind of a big group effort. So we really appreciate everybody who helped and everybody who gave their time. If you're visiting with us, we've done a series of lessons entitled Me and My Money. And no, this is not a drive for new contribution, but unless you feel so inclined, and then okay. But the reason I did it wasn't because, you know, the church is in the red. As people ask, you know, are we not in the black anymore? You know, that has nothing to do with that. The reason I did it was because I think that a lot of times there are things that probably stress us out at home. And among the big four that stress us out, money is probably the number one. And I tell everyone who I intend on marrying, not like a new wife, like a couple. I tell every couple, I said, there's four things that's going to get you in trouble. So there are four things, if you don't pay attention to, you just won't talk about them. And before you know it, it's a bigger problem than you thought it was. And so 98% of marriages fail for one of four reasons. And of course, they fail because people split up. But the reasons that they do, and in no particular order, but you can guess, money is one. Then there's sex. And then kids. Sorry, kids, you are stressful. Anybody know what the fourth one is? Mom and dad. Yeah, mom and dad. Some of you moms are saying, not me. Yes, you. Yes. So it's usually one of those four. You know, and it could be that neither of the couples are used to handling money. It's just something small as that we want to take care of our kids. But, you know, when you guys raised your kids, I'm sure y'all got the same manual that I got. We didn't get one. And so, you know, all of these things kind of happen. Money usually ends up being at the top of the list. So the reason we did this series is because I think it's important for Christian people to talk openly about the idea of money. And most of the time we just have a sermon and Jesus says you can't serve two masters, so don't serve money, you should get rid of it, give it to the church. You know, so that could be the cookie cutter sermon. But what I wanted to do this morning is to end this by talking about money and what we can learn from rich people. And if you're like me, most of the time you see some rich people and all I want to do is I want to get the money they got. And if you're part of my generation, of course, you know Bill Gates, you know Berkshire Hathaway, and I'm sure a lot of you have stock in Berkshire Hathaway, with, you know, Warren Buffett's company. If some of you don't know, this is Mr. Bezos all the way to your right, and he is the CEO and founder of Amazon. And, you know, when I was growing up, Bill Gates was the richest man on earth. Not anymore. Mr. Bezos is the richest man. I think it's like $112 billion is what he's worth. Yeah, some of us are thinking, if I could just have a piece, just a fraction. You know, these guys are extremely wealthy, and the temptation is to want to know more about them or to read more about them or to study them so you can learn to get rich. But here's what I've learned. None of these guys behind me, none of these three men set out to be rich. If you read about them, what you'll discover is that they don't sit around all day thinking, how do I hold on to my money? What these men have in common is that they have a product that a lot of people want. And because they have a product, let's just do a show of hands. How many of you have gotten on Amazon at least once in the last month? Amazon.com. Okay, look, maybe here's a better one. How many of you have never been on Amazon.com? A quarter of us. Yeah, Mr. Bezos is not happy. No. But most of us have, okay, or how many of us have a computer? This is what these men have in common, and I think a lot of us are not going to go home and invent the next I don't know. But what these men do have in common is that they are disciplined men, and so we have a temptation to look at people who have money and think, well, if I just had some of their money, or if I could do that, if I could do that. But what I like to do is to look at rich people and try to get an understanding about how they live their life. Because I will tell you something, if you have a lot of money, you won't keep your money. if you're undisciplined. These aren't the richest men ever to have lived in the United States. If you want to watch some documentaries or you want to see some other things, but Andrew Carnegie and J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller, these men are probably the richest men in American history, especially John D. Rockefeller. He is the richest man in American history. One person wrote a report on Rockefeller, said if Rockefeller's money was looked at today and the kind of power that he had because of the money, it would be as if he was worth $250 billion. That's a lot of money. I read a lot about Rockefeller, and what I learned is that he was a man who liked to live this disciplined life. He liked to live this life so that he liked to have these principles that he could live by. And I want to share three of them with you. Here's what Rockefeller said. He said, everyone should live their life with relentless persistence. That means whatever you decide to do, you ought to do it with all your heart. And don't stop until you do it. You got to get it done. Number two, control your emotions. Never complain and never explain. You know, if you have to explain yourself, you went too far. Okay? Say what you need to say and leave, and don't react out of emotions. And then here's the last one. Check your ego. Always know that you can be better tomorrow. Now, I started to think, if I follow all three of those, will I be rich like Rockefeller? Probably not. Probably not. Unfortunate. I wish that was a great sermon. Everybody would come hear that. But what I learned is that people who are good with money know how to handle themselves. So I thought about all these rich people, and then I thought, what if somebody wrote a book on the richest man ever to have lived? What if somebody could write that book? What would they say? And so I set out to look in the Proverbs. And I scanned the Proverbs, and I read the Proverbs, and I'm reading it for 2 months. And if Solomon had secrets to offer all of us about money, what would they be? And so instead of just, you know, writing a book and what's the Solomon secret, if you read through Proverbs, I started putting them in categories. And what I've discovered is that there are five principles. Now, this is not five principles to get rich, okay? Sorry. I don't know how to do that. You can play the lottery, but I'm pretty sure you're going to be disappointed. So there are five principles that you need to know when it comes about money. And if you already know about money, good for you. Great. But Solomon seems to have learned that these five principles are always active. So whether you have a lot of money or whether you don't have a lot of money, whether you're, you know, chasing Rockefeller or going the other way, these are the five principles that I think Solomon would tell all of us. And the interesting part is that when we get done, what we'll notice is that these five principles, what they have to do about money, they also have to do with life. So if you got a pen or you want to, I'm going to show you a lot of the Proverbs this morning so you can actually see them. Again, this is not five ways to get rich. It's just five things everybody needs to know about money. Here's the first. Money doesn't grow on trees. But if it did, it would grow very, very slowly. Anybody in here have a garden? You lay the seed out. How long does it take for the seed to come up? That night? Tomorrow? My son just aerated our grass yesterday. We got to, you know, put some seed, and I was out there staring out the window this morning. I wonder if I see some new grass. You know, it's the dumbest thing you can think of. Yeah, that's not going to grow. But yet, okay, so we're all kind of laughing like, that's so stupid. But yet, how many of us think that money's just going to pop up like that? Money grows very, very slowly. If you know that your crops will grow slowly, are you going to eat it all in one day? You kind of see where I'm going? How about we look at some Proverbs? In Proverbs 10, verse 4, Solomon says, lazy hands will make you poor, but diligent hands bring wealth. If money grows very, very slowly, that means we have to work every day. Every day. This is how money works. How about Proverbs 13:11? And this is, I think I put the Message behind me, but here's the NIV. Dishonest money dwindles away, but the one who gathers money little by little makes it grow. You ever heard the phrase, too good to be true? It is too good to be true. Usually it's not. You know, do I got a deal for you? Bad idea. Bad idea. You invest with us, we'll make you 30%. Bad idea. Bad idea. Do you know what age group is the most susceptible to get-rich-quick schemes? I thought it was millennials, because we always want to blame millennials. You look at the news. Everyone blames millennials. So if you're a millennial, sorry, we blame you guys all the time. But the age group that is most susceptible to get-rich-quick, anybody know? 70 to 80 years old. Thought y'all were supposed to be the wise ones. And I thought, well, maybe they just edged out millennials. Millennials are the least likely to get swindled into get-rich-quick schemes. Do you know why? Because they're swimming in so much debt, they know it's impossible. We got $250,000 in school debt. We got another $15,000 in credit card debt. You know, we're living with mom and dad. Yeah, there's no way out. We're going to die in this. You know, but you get older, and you got a lot of bills, medications, and all of a sudden you start to get desperate. And it's not like this age group edges out. This age group is way ahead of the rest of us. So I guess I say that to say you're never too old to learn something about money. And we're never too old to get hurt by money. But I want you to listen to this. Fast money doesn't last. Read to you Proverbs 20:21. An inheritance quickly gained at the beginning will not be blessed at the end. And I know some of these proverbs y'all are thinking, we already know this. Good for you. But do you? Forbes magazine in 2012, I didn't know this, reported that Allen Iverson, who I watched religiously in the NBA, made over $200 million in a 16-year NBA career, and 6 months after finishing, was bankrupt. I read that and I thought, how do you lose $200 million? But then, Sports Illustrated put out a report that 82% of all NBA players are broke within 5 years after leaving the game. And I thought to myself, and if you played in the NBA, I wasn't talking about you. But I thought to myself, what dumb athletes. They've been blessed with all this money and then they blow it. Again, if you played in the NBA, not you. We like you. But then I saw another survey about lottery winners in Florida. Average age, over 55. Out of the 3,500 who've won over $1 million, in the state of Florida, over 3,000 were bankrupt within 2 years. It's not just athletes, folks. Fast money doesn't last long. You know why? Because we got it fast, and so it leaves fast. If it's fast coming, it's fast going. If it's fast coming, it's fast going. Think about this in life. Whatever comes fast ain't going to stay with you long. It just never does. Because you're not used to it, and so we're not used to gaining it. I know some of you are thinking about your parents, and you think, well, I don't know, my parents got a lot of money fast. No, they didn't. It's just when you left. Then they started making money. And I know we're like, it's true. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, my parents didn't have any money growing up. I mean, they were broke. They just broke. I remember thinking, you know, why are we so poor? And then, you know, 10 years later, I look and, you know, my younger brother's in college, and all of a sudden I see my dad slipping in money, and I think, preaching must pay a whole lot more now than it used to, huh, Pops? Yeah. But then I got to thinking about it. Me and my older brother aren't around, you know, being leeches to my mom and dad. Yeah. It's not that money comes fastest. And also, I think that your parents probably have more money than they used to, not only because you're gone, but because sometimes it takes 30, 40 years to learn to be diligent with money. Wisdom does not come to young people. Wisdom happens over time. Money comes very, very slowly. That's principle number one. Number two, I'll try to go faster with the rest of them. Save. Put all your nuts in the tree. Save, 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 save. If money comes very, very slowly and it comes little at a time, if you spend too much tomorrow, there's not going to be a lot to come. And so we have to learn to put back. Solomon says, he who gathers money little by little makes it grow. Little by little. Twice in the book of Proverbs, Solomon says, do you know who I admire? The ant. Read to you Proverbs 6, verse 6. He says, go to the ant, you lazy bum. That's my translation. He says sluggard, but I kind of think sluggard's outdated, so we're going with lazy bum. Go to the ant, you lazy bum, and consider its ways and be wise. The ant has no commander to tell it what to do. It has no overseer. It has no ruler. And yet it stores up all its food in the summer, and it gathers its food at the harvest. It just stores up food. At one point, Solomon says, he was talking about all these creatures on the earth, and he says, ants are creatures of little strength, and yet they store up all their food in the summer. I know we all complain about, you know, the five-day work week and how many hours we have to do this. My father's generation was born, this is the generation born between 46 and 64. I still think we call these the baby boomer generation. This generation stands to inherit, I think it's $12 million. Not my dad, but my father's generation. A lot of you. Stands to inherit $12 million in the next 10 to 20 years from their parents. A lot of them are inheriting it right now. Their parents were called the silent generation. The ones born between 1925 and 1949. My generation will inherit $30 million over the next 30 to 40 years. The millennial generation, do you know how much they're set to inherit? Remember, my generation is set to, I'm supposed to inherit 30 million. I'm pretty sure it's not coming. But I'm supposed to inherit 30 million. My generation is total. But millennials, do you know how much you're supposed to inherit? So let's make sure we understand this pattern. It went from 12, it's going to jump to 30. Nine. We were doing this. What happened? We're going to blow all your money. My generation is going to blow every dime. That's what those numbers mean. I mean, does everybody see that? You know, this generation learned to save, this generation learned to save, and then my generation, you know what we were taught to do? Put it on a card. If you don't have it, it's okay. Pay it tomorrow. The debt. My generation wasn't taught to save. It's an awful thing. My grandparents' generation, sometimes called the greatest generation, the average income for my grandparents was $5,000 a year. Only 15% of their homes had indoor toilets. Life expectancy was 47 years. And this is when they were my age. And the work week was 60 hours over 6 days. I remember my grandfather telling me his average pay was $1.60 an hour, and he felt like he was on top of the world. And yet, we all complain about 38-hour weeks and not getting our 21 days vacation. And we still have no money to show. Save, save, save. Put your money away. I don't know if we should be putting back so that our next children and their children can have all this money, but Solomon says in chapter 13, verse 22, the text we read this morning, a good person leaves an inheritance for his children's children. A sinner's wealth is stored up for the righteous. And I don't think this means that if you don't leave your kids a bunch of money, then, well, you're going to go to hell. I think Solomon is really talking about people who don't store up at all. There are those who store up and want to take care of their families, and there are those who don't want to store anything, and you have nothing in your storehouse. Number three. This is something we don't think about. And again, my generation, I wasn't taught to do this. Take care of your tools. There are things that we all have in life, and there are things that we have possessions of. And Solomon thinks you ought to take care of that. I like this proverb right here. This is Proverbs 24, verse 30. He says, I went past the field of the lazy bum. Again, it's my translation. I went past the vineyard of the man who lacks judgment. Thorns had come up everywhere. The ground was covered with weeds, and the stone wall was in ruins. I looked at his house, and I thought to myself, a little sleep, a few naps, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon my friend like a thief. Did y'all catch what Solomon's saying? I'll do that tomorrow. I'll do that tomorrow. All of a sudden, the grass is too tall to mow. My son mowed our grass yesterday. He's outside all day. Thank goodness, because that means I didn't have to be. But he was, you know, he was aerating and he was mowing and he had the big mower out. And I got there and he's standing beside the creek and he's got the hose and he's washing off the mower. Thinking, what for? Just throw it in the barn. But he has this understanding that you take care of your tools. You know, if the grass is, if you don't want the grass just sit. Well, what will that do? Well, not much, except over time it starts to dull blades. And people ought to take care of their tools. And I don't just mean if you're mowing, you need to wash off your mower, although that would probably help. But I do think that this generation, every generation, needs to learn to take care of their stuff. We love accumulating stuff. But we don't take care of the stuff we have. You know, if it breaks, just buy a new one. Again, my generation was taught if the blender breaks, just go to Walmart and get a new one. If the iron goes out, just go get a new one. But I would bet all the money in my pocket, which is zero, but I would bet all the money in my pocket that if J.R. Scott had something break in his house, he ain't going to buy a new one. One, because he probably has eight of them in his yard. But I would imagine that J.R. would probably try to fix it. And I would imagine that J.R. probably knows that it's close to being broke anyways because he's been maintaining it. There's this idea that we need to maintain our stuff. And some of us may think, well, what does this have to do with money? A lot. If you buy something and you don't take care of it, you have to buy it again. And so there's this principle of taking care of what you own. And I don't want you to think this just has to do with money. Let us think about our marriages. What do we do when it starts to break? What does our country think you ought to do? Go get a new one. Why not? We've had it for 7 years. We've had it for 4 years. Some of us had this blender for 22 years. Used to work really good. Got it for a great price. And now it just doesn't work right anymore. Could it be that it's not that they don't make things like they used to? Could it be that in this marriage, this blender was making a lot of noises like 10 years ago, and we just kept on ignoring it? It ain't just about money, folks. These are principles for life. And I don't mean take care of your tool. It doesn't mean your husband's a tool. It just means the things in your house, let us learn to care for them so that they can last. Number four, don't borrow money. Again, these are just principles. You don't have to do these. You can do these. You cannot do these. But hey, money comes slow, so let's make our decisions based upon that. You need to save all that you can. We need to work hard. We need to take care of our tools. And to be honest with you, don't borrow. Don't borrow. And I know that's impossible. We all got to have a house. You got to have a credit card to have credit. I understand all this stuff. Proverbs 22, verse 7, the rich will rule over the poor, and the borrower is a servant to the lender. I know you have to borrow. As long as you understand, you are breaking a rule. When you break a rule, there are consequences. And I've broken them. I'm still breaking it. But any wealthy person will tell you, don't borrow. And here's why. If you need a washer and dryer, and you don't have no money, and you don't have any money, why? Because you didn't save. And you didn't save because you thought money grew on trees at a fast rate. So you got the doctor bill, and you went to the doctor, you went to the clinic. And the clinic was just a $15 copay. A year ago it was. But because you went there and you had some blood tests run, they had to send those blood tests off. And yes, you just have a $15 copay, but now you got the bill in the mail. And how much is the bill for the tests they ran? $200. So you got to pay the $200, and then you got a bill in the mail from the doctor's office. Now, we know you paid the copay, but that's just what you pay that day. That's just a convenience thing. The doctor had to run the test. The doctor had to do things. So you owe him about $175. So you're go to the doctor and see what happens. So it's $200. Now we're up to $375. And so you got a check. You kind of have an emergency fund, and that's gone. And then you know what happened? The kid broke his leg. or some other kid had something else happen. Now you got to take them back to the doctor. And so you take them, but you didn't pay the last bill. And so when you get there, you don't owe $375, there's interest. Now you owe $5 something. And they're not going to see your kid until you pay the bill. What are you going to do? And then you get home and the washer and dryer comes out. This is not my life, in case some of you are thinking, wow, this guy's life stinks. On the other hand, I think all of you would probably agree, isn't that life? Washer, wife meets you at the door. Washer leaked everywhere. Well, at least the dryer's still on. Well, it was, except that it got next to the extension cord and burned that up. I told you to put the extension cord up, but you didn't want to do that because the wire was getting frayed, and you thought that duct tape was the means of taking care of your tools. Men, I'm talking to you. And scotch tape is not duct tape, by the way. So now the washer and dryer's broke. You don't have any money because we already spent it. We spent the emergency fund. We still owe for that. And so we go to Lowe's and we find that we can buy a washer for $522 and we can buy a dryer for $370. Hot dog. $892 with Tennessee tax. Guess $1,000. Okay. However, if you get a Lowe's card, it is 12 months. No interest. You got to pay it in 12 months. Do you know how many, the percentage of people who actually pay it off in 12 months? 9. If you don't pay it off in 12 months, then it's 28% interest. By the way, it's 28% interest on all the 12 months that you didn't pay for. It's retroactive. It starts way back here. So with a $1,000 washer, if you make the minimum payment, in 9 years you would have paid it off. But you actually would have spent $3,200. Don't borrow. If you borrow, you will pay 3, 4, 5 times as much money. And some of you are doing like, I learned this lesson. And yet we keep learning it. I say we, okay? I'm with you. Average college student will graduate with $4,100 in credit card debt. This is to say nothing of his school debt. 20% of seniors over the age of 70 have over $10,000 on their credit cards. If you have $10,000 on a credit card and you never charge another thing and you pay $160 a month, it will take you 14 years to pay it off. And at the end of a $10,000 debt, you would have paid $26,000. I know we all know this, but do we? And here's this, and I know this is kind of part of it. Let me back that up just a second here. Don't help others borrow either. Solomon's real big on co-signing. Mom and dad, bad idea. Real bad idea. Because he's not going to pay that truck. He's not going to make that payment. They will come for you. Don't co-sign. I'm just a messenger, folks. Proverbs 6, verse 1, he says, "My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, if you have struck hands in pledge with the bank, if you have been trapped by what you said, then you need to go get out of that loan." Solomon doesn't think you should ever borrow. And here's the last one. Give your money away. Doesn't that sound like contradictory? Money comes slow, so you need to keep it. You need to save it. You need to take care of your stuff. Don't borrow. Keep everything away. And then Solomon says, and then give it away. What? You know how long it took me to save all this? Proverbs 3, verse 9, it says, "Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops." Giving money to the church in contribution. Giving money to the Lord. And by the way, giving money to the political candidate is not a tithe. I know some of us think that is. That's not a tithe. I mean, I know, like, I gave it to this person's campaign and that counts. No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. Giving to God will allow you, it puts a shield against greed. There are people who need money. Proverbs 3:28, don't say to your neighbor, "Come back later, I'll give it to you tomorrow." if you already have it with you today. Hey man, you got $10? Ooh, yeah, but I might need that. Solomon says, give it to them. I know it seems as if they're being contradictory, but money is so important and so strong that it'll consume you if you're not careful. This is what Solomon wants. He wants this balanced. And I know some of us want to help others to make these loans, but Solomon says if you have someone and they need to go make a $5,000 loan, don't co-sign it. What would Solomon tell you to do? Just give him the money. Just give him the money. It's important for us to learn how to handle money so that we can learn how to handle life. These are not separate entities. Learning what God wants from us in a financial way will actually help us learn what he wants from us in a spiritual way. There's this there's a story about Rockefeller, and it's in the book Titan. It's in Ron Chernow's book Titan. And if you haven't read it, it's a fantastic book. But he tells the story, and Chernow doesn't know if it's legend or not, but here goes. There's a man sitting on a bench, and he was the CEO of a company, and he was about to file bankruptcy. And he was actually contemplating suicide. It was just a bad time. And there was a man who came up to him, kind of scraggly, wore some scraggly clothes, an older gentleman, and he said, "Sir, are you okay?" And the man said, "Honestly, no, I'm about to lose my company." And the man asked him about his company, and the man on the bench told him. And the guy went away, and then he came right back, and he handed him a check for $500,000. He said, "Sir, you seem like a hard worker. You seem like someone who values a dollar. And I want to help you get out of the situation. Here's $500,000. You take this, you put it into your company, and a year from now, let's meet again. Get a hold of this person, and we're going to meet. You give me back the money, and I think you'll have your company back. I believe in you." The guy looked at the check, John D. Rockefeller. The guy went back home, looked at his business, and he was so impressed that Rockefeller thought so. John, it would be like you met Bill Gates, and he said, "I really like you. I want to believe in you. Wow, I must be somebody special." And so he was so proud of himself that he said, "You know what? I'm just going to work hard. I'm going to dig in. I'm going to figure out this." And the guy did not cash Rockefeller's check, but he got himself out of his problem. Because in his head, he thought, "Rockefeller, and if Rockefeller believes I can do it, then I can do anything." And he did it. And a year later, he gets a hold of his woman that the guy told him to con. He got a hold of the woman. "I need to talk to this person." And he went, and he met him at the park, and then there's Rockefeller. And he goes to give him the check, and Rockefeller asks him, "Why didn't you take it?" And the man told him, I knew I could do it. If you believed in me, and I believed in me, and I just did it, and I want to thank you for that." And at that very moment, the woman comes behind the older man. And she says, "There you are." She said, "I'm sorry, he gets out sometimes." And the man said, "Well, he should. He's John D. Rockefeller." And she said, "No, he's not." He said, "He's actually a patient at this hospital, but he loves to tell people that he's John D. Rockefeller." He said, "Well, the man gave me this check." She said, "He gives everybody checks." Here's what I love about that story, is that here's a man who took control of his life simply because someone else believed in him. Simply because someone saw him, not for who he was, but for who he could be. Church, this is really not a lesson about money. It's really not a lesson about taking care of your finances. This is how we as a people make it. Because I promise you, there is someone who sees you for who you can be, not for who you are. And no matter how much trouble financially we get ourselves in, there is someone who believes in you, and this world is not your final destination. Don't let mammon tell you otherwise. And in order to listen to the one who whispers, we are going to have to take better care of our finances. You cannot serve two masters. You will serve the one you feed. There is someone this morning who believes in you, and I assure you, he is very much alive. He doesn't want to make you rich, but he wants to enrich your soul. What say you as we stand and sing?